Hi, this is Sedge Thompson. Welcome to this special audio highlights podcast from West Coast Live. For more information about our shows and other guests and podcasts, wcl.org. I'm going to read a little bit of from the review of the San Francisco Chronicle that's appearing tomorrow for this next book, Morality Tale by Sylvia Brunrig. It's a 21st century cautionary tale whose generic title evokes the morality play, an allegorical and didactic form common in the 15th century. The novel pivots on a married man's choice to start an affair, which actually, that's not quite right, is it? Because he and his lover want to save each other. What's wrong with that, another character asks. And it goes on to say, here the narrator, a nameless second wife struggling with her marriage, can be seen as a version of every woman. And goes on to say, unconventional in content, Morality Tale is also uniquely presented. It's 10 chapters, each illustrated, or, as we like to call it, illuminated, with a charming line drawing by Monica Scott, are labeled with actual or metaphorical scene settings. And the chapters come with prefaces, too. Savage little aperçu that could easily be lifted from a dictionary of betrayal, the dark novel the second wife was writing when Alan first met her. A collection of words and their meanings that would gradually build a story, a world, betrayal, abandonment, grief, sex, lying, revenge. Morality Tale isn't a dictionary of betrayal. It's a witty parable, a slight but subtle dissection of modern marriage, its ideals and banalities, ghosts and bit part players, including a laughably ineffectual marital therapist named Puffin. Illuminated by its sympathy toward its oddly innocent cast of characters, it presents the dilemmas of daily commitment and redemption in a form even burnt-out cynics might find palatable. This is Brownrigg's fourth novel, following The Delivery Room, which is going to come out in this country in November, which was not only highly praised, but also noted by some reviewers for its pin-sharp realism. And like its earlier book, Pages for You, Brownrigg's second novel, which evoked the bipolar experience of first love. These two chamber pieces, with their brevity, virtuosity, and egg-like completeness, sit in a kind of equipoise, songs of innocence and experience, which is a Blake reference. This author can do them both and rather more besides. That's from the review by Elspeth Lindner in the going to be in the Chronicle. Now, the only reason I read this is because I can't say these things myself because I'm married to our next guest. And so, therefore, I had to have somebody else speak some things. So, So we were laughing around one day when we came across this quotation by Alexandre Dumas. Mm-hmm. So heavy is the chain of wedlock that it needs two to carry it, and sometimes three. Yeah. And from thence swung and became the origins of this novel called Morality Tale. Please welcome Sylvia Brunrig to West Coast Live.
How do you do?
Thank you so much for being in here.
It's okay, you're allowed to kiss some of the guests.
Yes. I signed a permission slip.
You signed the permission, the release that the host could kiss you?
That's right. I was trying to think of a Mother's Day connection, and in that review, I think egg-like completeness.
Egg-like equipose?
Yeah, something like that.
Egg-like equipose. So it was nice. I mean, it was a nice review. It was a nice review. And so part of this book is the... I was struck by the description of the characters as innocents, and throughout the novel, the characters are largely unnamed, except for one. And
I was listening to Robbie's description of how he named characters, and I sort of went through, and then you've been talking about storytelling and tale telling, and I've been asked why this is a tale and what makes this a tale rather than sort of more. You know, more conventionally a novel, and it's very important to me that the main character is never named. The husband is unnamed until the last chapter, and his name is a certain sort of revelation, which is the moment when he sort of regains his full humanity in a way, and becomes more of a person and less somebody that she's turned into a kind of an everyman. But it was important to me that she remained unnamed. And it's been interesting, the few reviews that have come in so far, which people have allowed her to be unnamed and which people think... There's one nickname that's assigned her, and some people think that's what she has to be called. But she actually has two sort of epithets that are assigned to her. One person calls her Angel, and somebody else calls her Pan. But I think she never gets a name.
And Pan is also sort of an impish kind of name, too.
Yes, it's one. I mean, it can be thought of as the devil in some.
It could be a devil. It could be an angel. Who knows? In those ways. But the book is also about triangles of all kinds. It's about triangles in a marriage. There's a former wife. There are children who can be part of a triangle. I suppose there are other kinds of triangles that exist.
Yes, we were talking about that earlier. I was thinking about that moment in an interview that Princess Diana gave rather poignantly when she described, there were three people in this marriage, which made it rather crowded, and she was referring, you know, poor thing, to her husband's mistress, you know, former and future, I guess. And that's a very sort of memorable and poignant description. But I was I was thinking about how you could invert that quote and think about the way that sometimes when there are just two people in a marriage, it can feel a bit lonely. And so I think different couples sometimes choose a third party to sort of keep the conversation going, whether it's a child. The cat, the boat, you know.
Golf.
Exactly. The garden, perhaps. So I think there are different ways that a third person, in this case, it's figured, in this story, it's usually figured as a person. And a third person can function in different ways. I mean, both obviously as a way of separating two people, but also in a funny way, if it's a common enemy, you know, it can sort of unite them. So I was interested in that way, that couples use a third person to find their way back to one another.
Because ultimately, I mean, this is a hopeful book.
It is.
But it's also comic.
Yes, it is both. Yes, sort of ruefully comic.
Ruefully comic.
But yes, it is. It's an optimistic book, and I knew that... I wanted it to be. It's funny, the friend who's a wonderful artist, although she actually makes her living as a musician, who did the drawings for the book, I gave her a slightly mischievous assignment, which was that I gave her the chapter titles before I let her read the book. So she was drawing these essentially metaphorical capturings of different moments in the story without knowing what they were representing in the story. And the last of the 10 pictures was the house in the clearing. And so it was funny to be able to tell her the kind of, I mean, I wasn't going to tell her exactly how to do the drawing, but I said, I want a house that just feels very clear and peaceful, and there's nobody really around, and it just, you know, it's a haven. And that was, and, you know, I actually told her that, I think, before I'd even written that chapter.
Here's one called Plaid Living Room Set.
Yes, I'm afraid the plaid living room set refers to the husband's former wife, who is sort of like a piece of furniture that you inherit from when you move into a house and you somehow can't get rid of it because it's just sort of there. And it's not the pattern you would have chosen, and it's really not the set you would have chosen, but you have to accommodate it. So that was quite funny. I think when she read the chapter, she's like, oh, that's what the plaid living room set was. She did some wonderful research to find. I kept saying, it has to be a really not very attractive plaid living room set. So when she was finding how to draw that picture.
Well, there was reference to Puffin, the marital therapist counselor, and this is from the chapter entitled The Stage Set. So could we hear a little bit of your novel?
Yes. I thought, given that we are doing this show in the Bay Area and that we live here, I think that the sort of the comedy of the couples counseling scene is one that I hope has a certain resonance in the Bay Area, where this is a kind of common currency. Actually, the first time I read from this was at a gay and lesbian reading group, and I was, you know, thinking, well, this is a book that's really about marriage, and I hope that doesn't, you know, alienate the readers. But I think so. I decided to read the couples counseling scene, and there were some there were some knowing smiles and laughs there too. So at this point, I'm just going to read a couple of pages. They have decided to see the counselor, whose name I'm afraid is Puffin. The ex-wife's name is Teresa. I had thought it might come to Puffin eventually. Disaster on this scale usually did. My husband might sound in most respects like a regular guy, with the TV watching, the suit, the bad temper. But where we live in the West, even a regular guy has to have some kind of emotional vocabulary and be willing to go to a counselor when crisis strikes. like the time 3 years earlier when my husband had misguidedly encouraged Teresa to visit our condo. In a spirit of rapprochement she did not happen to share, and she'd furiously torn family pictures off the boys' bedroom wall and flung them onto the floor. These and a few other memorable events had each sent us to Puffin. Dr. Edward Puffin was a silver-haired, pointy, goateed man with a mild, sleight-of-hand voice who in another setting might pass for a magician or wizard. There did seem to be a supernatural element in his work. Sometimes you felt that he succeeded by hypnotizing the warring parties assembled in the room and briefly brainwashing them into a cessation of hostilities so they could stay together for a little longer at least. He might have counted to 10, then, unbeknownst to his patients, snapped his fingers, collected his hefty fee, and sent the couple on their way, gently rearranging the furniture after one pair left so that the next two could come into his stage set of an office where they enacted their sad or furious kitchen sink dramas. When you entered this theater of negotiation, Puffin always organized his face to appear both happy and sorry to see you. He maintained a mournful cast, made more poignant by the goatee, that suggested the sense, "I regret that it has come to this." Yet he wanted to exude reassurance. "Please sit," he would say with a wistful smile. "Tell me what's happening." And the language, with its 70s perfume, and Puffin himself, with his otherworldly charm, might make you think for a fanciful moment that this greeting was really the opening for a group orgy or a key-swapping party. Maybe we were going to break out of those boring 50s conventions of fidelity and propriety, after all, explore the more modern possibilities of marriage. And then her husband starts speaking. "There's a guy, a fat guy, who sells envelopes." And she thinks, "Or maybe not."
A scene from Morality Tale by Sylvia Brownrigg, the novel published by Counterpoint. What is the, why the structure of a tale, a morality tale, something where characters are innocents and they don't have names and there's a kind of a, yet a very keen layering of character?
It's funny. I mean, I was thinking about the different ways I've written these novels, and the review that you were quoting from likens this novel to my novel Pages for You, and I do seem to have two really different structures and methods somehow in the novels that I've written, and some are these very long and really usually very carefully realistic novels with a much broader cast of characters, and in those novels it's important to me, I sort of can't help myself knowing the history, the exact history of each character and who their parents are and probably more or less what kind of schooling they had. And the delivery room is very much that kind of layered story with many different characters and many different perspectives. And in this tale, I think I really wanted it to be a sort of elemental tale about, you know, couples and some of the things that happen in a couple. And so I really didn't want to know anything much about anybody's parents. I didn't really want to know anything about their schooling. I mean, it's interesting, Robbie was saying that the fairy tale enabled him to access emotions that, or to allow the characters to have emotions that in a more realistic novel they might not be able to have. And in a funny way, it's almost the inverse with this being a tale, that I can keep the emotions very, very compressed and compact. It's not exactly an unrealistic story. It all could have happened, but there's just a slight aura of the other world. I mean, that description of Puffin is a bit, you know, it's all a bit slightly cartoonish at points.
There's a word that you made up in here where you have two of the characters walking past and you're describing the street scene. There are various cafes and restaurants and, can you pronounce it correctly?
Yes, trinquetteria.
Trinquetteria.
Yes. So,
and you made up that word.
I did. it's funny, actually. In one place, the character is described as an autodidact because she uses big words or complicated words. But
take on a couple and a marriage and sort of the triangles of what goes on between a therapist, patients, and a spouse.
It's a very different kind of marriage depicted. The couple is older. They have a very peaceful marriage, and the conflict and the difficulties are not between the two people at all. It's in the outer world. It's the war that's arriving in her country because she's Serbian. It's the terrible pains that are brought to her by her patients. And this is the couple in the delivery room is a childless couple. So and that's also a very it was a very deliberate decision on my part and on their part. And in fact, when she describes that some couples wonder, you know, friends of theirs who do have children say, you know, sort of wonder, what do you have to talk about at a certain point? I mean, because they're aware of how much their children are the conversation between them. And for her, the world and the life she has with her husband is just incredibly rich, and she wouldn't want it to be diluted with conversations about children. And she also feels that a lot of her emotional energy goes into her patients, and that she probably couldn't be as committed to her patients if she had children.
But that's also, I mean, this reads as a very California book. Morality Tale. The Delivery Room, set in London, reads as an English novel. I mean, it's like you have two different voices that you call on, different languages in a way.
I am two people.
You are two people.
I am two people.
Could you speak more in your English accent?
Perhaps afterwards we can.
Trails that prefaces the first chapter in your English accent.
They're American. They're American. They are. I mean, so the first entry, so the character was, when she got married, was working on something. It was described in that review as a novel. I'm not sure I thought it was a novel, but anyway, she was working on some whatever it was that was called A Dictionary of Betrayal. And so this story has 10 different definitions scattered, you know, at the beginning of each chapter. And the first one, the definition is for betrayal. And the little definition is, it's more complicated than you think. Don't leap to conclusions. There may be hidden angles you haven't considered. Above all, we're human, and that we includes you.
The book is called Morality Tale by Sylvia Brownrigg, published by Counterpoint. Thank you very much for being here. This is Edge Thompson. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Try out others from West Coast Live right here, and we look forward to having you in one of our audiences one day. For more information, wcl.org.